The Guardian.
Hi, Nicola Davis here. Before you get started with this edition of Science Weekly, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase.
This episode of Science Weekly is also brought to you by Get Into Teaching. Teaching is a career that allows you to make a real difference to young people's lives, and it's a great way to make your degree, skills, and knowledge really count. By sharing your passion for physics, chemistry, and biology with the next generation, you could get £25,000 tax-free to train, subject to availability, selected subjects only. To find out more, search Get Into Teaching and register for tailored advice to start your teaching career, or head to getintoteaching.education.gov.uk.
And now, on with the show.
On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. But as it will take me 2 or 3 more years to complete it, and as my health is far from strong, I've been urged to publish this abstract. I have more especially been induced to do this as Mr. Wallace, who is now studying the natural history of the Malay archipelago, has arrived at almost exactly the same general conclusions that I have on the origin of species.
On the 24th of November, 1859, Charles Darwin published his seminal On the Origin of Species, laying out what would later become the foundations of our understanding of evolution. One of the most important pieces of scientific literature to date, Darwin's ideas revolved around evolution by what he called natural selection.
In considering the origin of species, it is quite conceivable that a naturalist reflecting on the mutual affinities of organic beings, on their embryological relations, their geographical distribution, geological succession, and other such facts, might come to the conclusion that each such species had not been independently created, but had descended like varieties from other species.
Over 150 years later, Darwin's ideas still underpin our understanding of evolution, but a group of academics are beginning to call for an update. Known as extended evolutionary synthesis, it challenges the gene-centric foundations much of the field is built on.
Naturalists continually refer to external conditions such as climate, food, etc., as the only possible cause of variation. In one very limited sense, as we shall hereafter see, this may be true, but it is preposterous to attribute to mere external conditions the structure, for instance, of the woodpecker, with its feet, tail, beak, and tongue so admirably adapted to catch insects under the bark of trees.
But what is extended evolutionary synthesis? Is there any evidence for it? And why have so many fellow biologists branded it as unnecessary?
Absolutely requiring the agency of certain insects.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
Hello.
Hello. Hi there. Is that Massimo? To help me get my head around this extended evolutionary synthesis, or EES, I spoke to one of the movement's leading figures.
My name is Massimo Piliucci. I am the K.D. Irani Professor of Philosophy at the City College of New York.
I spoke with Massimo via Skype and started at the beginning.
So everyone knows about evolution and natural selection, how genetic mutations arise randomly and then get passed on or not. But Darwin and Wallace haven't had the last word, it would seem. Is that right?
Oh, by far. That's right. Which is not surprising if you think about it, because it's like saying that Newton had the last word about physics. I mean, that's the nature of science, right? You start out with certain ideas, you propose a theory, the theory seems to work very well, but then there is always a number of things that the theory either does not explain or has more trouble explaining. So science progresses that way. Initially, somebody proposes a theory, then if it fits the data pretty well, then, however, there are additional observations and new concepts are proposed to take into account those observations and experiments, and then at some point a new theory matures, or a new version of the theory matures, and it keeps going like this. I mean, this is pretty much what always happens in science. It's not like evolutionary biology is any different.
It seems that there's a big debate right now about which processes are fundamentally part of evolution. Talk me through the background to this. What's this all about?
Well, basically, evolutionary biology has gone through a number of phases, you know, evolutionary theory, I should say, has gone through a number of phases, starting out with Darwinism, the two fundamental ideas of the original version of Darwinism were common descent, that all organisms on Earth are related to each other, essentially, and then natural selection. However, the theory originally already was missing some big pieces. For instance, Darwin did not have a good theory of heredity. He did not know where the mutations, where the variation that is necessary for natural selection to operate was coming from. That was discovered by Mendel, of course, at the turn of the 20th century, sorry, the first decades of the 20th century. A number of scientists tried to put together what was called Mendelism, that is the rediscovery of Mendelian laws, with Darwinism. So that was the first major change in evolutionary theory, and it's what it's known as the modern synthesis. It took place between the 1920s and the 1940s. Then move forward a little bit, the latter part of the second part of the 20th century, you have the explosion of the molecular revolution, you have molecular biology coming into line to discover the structure of DNA, and then all the way up to the recent beginnings of genomics and a number of other subfields in biology that have been fueled by the molecular revolution. Now it turns out that a number of people, including myself, are arguing that perhaps we need to sort of come up with a new update, let's say, of the evolutionary framework, the evolutionary theory, something that we call the extended evolutionary synthesis. This extended synthesis would be precisely what it sounds like, that is, an updated version of the modern synthesis. And what it would synthesize is a number of new, not only a number of new experiments and observations, but also a number of new mechanisms that have been proposed for how evolution works.
So let's focus on the extended evolutionary synthesis. Let's sort of look a bit more at that, because I think people are very familiar, as I said at the start, about sort of Mendelian genetics. That's sort of something we all learn about at school. And I think that some of these other ideas, it's hard to see how they influence or are tied into evolution quite so obviously. So one of the areas that seems to be important in extended evolutionary synthesis is the role of how organisms grow and develop. Can you just talk me through that a bit?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about evolutionary, evolutionary developmental biology is what it's called now. That field is called EvoDevo, which is short for evolutionary biology.
Very snappy.
Yeah, that's right. It's a new field. It's, you know, it basically started out in the late 90s, mid to late 90s. And it's an interesting aspect of the evolutionary, the extended evolutionary synthesis, for the reason that the original synthesis, the modern synthesis of the 1930s and 40s, basically left evolutionary developmental biology out. Developmental biology was never synthesized, so to speak. It was never brought into the fold of the general theory for a number of reasons. First of all, because it's really difficult to study development at a molecular level and a cellular level if you don't have the tools of modern molecular biology, which of course were not available in the 1930s and 40s. But also because there'd been a long tradition of sort of disagreement between developmental biologists and evolutionary biologists, because developmental biologists tend to focus on structure, what are called structural explanations of things. To make it the long story short, they really never quite agreed on how to do these things and how to bring developmental biology into the fold. Move forward to the 1990s, and EvoDevo researchers were now finally got the tools to begin to really probe deeply into how developmental mechanisms actually occur, how organisms develop from a single cell into these really bewildering complexity and variety of forms. But now we also have sort of the conceptual tools to begin to apply evolutionary ideas to development itself. And so it turns out, for instance, just to give you one example of how this is done, it turns out that early versions of evolutionary theory basically assumed that the details of the developmental mechanism did not matter for evolution. That, you know, no matter how a particular organism develops, let's say hearts and lungs and eyes and things like that, you know, that's very interesting for the developmental biologist, but it doesn't make any difference in terms of evolution, because all that evolution cares, all that natural selection cares, is that, let's say, you do have eyes that are functional or lungs that are functional. It doesn't matter how you get them, okay? Well, it turns out that assumption is wrong. We've discovered over the last 20 years that it very much makes a difference on how you get the traits you get, because certain mutations are more likely than others. Mutations are not equally likely. They're not, as to use a technical term, they're not isotropic. There is no equal possibility of every mutation to occur. Developmental mechanisms themselves actually either constrain evolution or facilitate evolution, because there are certain developmental mechanisms that appear repeatedly more frequently than you would expect by chance, and others that actually are much more difficult to evolve.
Can you give me an example? I mean, just to help to illustrate it, because I think that it's one of those concepts that we're kind of slightly, it's quite technical, so it'd be good to just give us an example.
Sure. So for instance, if you take the evolution of digit numbers in salamanders. So salamanders are amphibian vertebrates, and they, different species have a different number of digits. So they have, some have to, you know, three or four or five, depending on the species. Now, people had noticed for a long time that it turns out that the evolution of the same number of digits happened repeatedly over a period of time in different species of salamanders. So they moved, a number of species moved from, let's say, three to four, or four to three, or, you know, the other way around. And fine, people simply assumed that, well, that's because natural selection somehow favored four digits, let's say, in one group, and three digits in another. But nobody could really figure out why would natural selection do that. I mean, it's like, what difference could it possibly make in the environment, in the typical environment of a salamander, whether these things have, you know, a variable number of digits or not, you know, one number of digits or not. And then recently we found out that it's got nothing to do with natural selection. It has to do with development. Turns out that the number of digits in salamanders depends very strictly, very closely, from the size of the salamander itself. Because if the species is larger, let's say, than average, then it's going to have a larger number of cells or larger cells during development, and those developed larger number of fingers. Basically, there is a correlation between the size of the cells or the number of cells and the number of digits. So it turns out that it had nothing to do with natural selection on digit number. It has to do with natural selection on body size, because some salamanders are more adaptive in certain environments when they're bigger, and others when they're smaller. That has to do with predation pressure and things like that. So that it is development and not natural selection that explains the variability in the number of digits. But unless you understand how the digits themselves are actually formed during development, you have no clue, and you just assume that, well, it must have been some advantage that natural selection worked on, and that was not the case.
This is just one of many examples that Massimo and his fellow champions of EES give to back their argument. A little later on, we'll look at some more. But another important aspect that falls into this extended synthesis is what's known as evolvability, essentially the evolution of evolution itself.
Right, have you got any questions before we go?
No, I'm happy, thank you.
This is Richard Watson.
I'm Richard Watson. I'm an associate professor in electronics and computer science at the University of Southampton.
Producer Max sat down with Richard in the studio and started by asking him about the often perceived randomness of evolution.
Yeah, the randomness is really important, right? So if you have a theory where organisms change their phenotype or physiology or behavior in a way which is, in a sense, premeditated to be better for the environment that they're in, well, then you haven't provided an explanation of how they got better for the environment that they're in. You just supposed that they could do it. So the cleverness of Darwin's contribution was to say, okay, I don't need to suppose that. Even if changes are entirely random, we can let natural selection figure out which ones were good and which ones were bad. I don't need to know in advance which ones are good so that I can produce them preferentially. It would be oversimplifying, I think, to say that evolution works by non-random processes. But there's a middle ground where you can say, although the variation is still random with respect to not knowing which things are going to be good in advance, the space of possibilities can be narrowed down. So that we're not considering, evolution is not considering all kinds of variations. It's considering a large number of variations, and most of them are worse. But the particular set that it's considering is, in a sense, an educated guess.
And this idea of an educated guess sort of brings in learning theory quite nicely. So for those people who don't know, what is learning theory very briefly.
So it's just the idea that a system improves in performance at some task with experience. So it's a relatively familiar idea. You get better by trying, by experience. There are simple ways in which that could happen and more interesting ways in which that could happen, and also some very complicated ways in which that could happen, right? So simple ways are just, look, if I happen to do a behavior which is good and I can see the rewards from doing it, then I'll do it more. What's distinctive about that is that it doesn't require any ability to know what to do in situations you haven't seen before, right? It could be just rote learning. You just repeat behaviors that have already been successful. Slightly more sophisticated, though, or in fact fundamental to the idea of learning theory, is that you can use past experience to respond appropriately to situations you haven't seen before by looking at the features or structures which are common to things you've seen in the past. You can recognize what to do in a new situation, even though it's not the same situation as anything you've seen before.
And so these kind of learning theories you applied to evolution itself in a recent paper. I mean, what first sparked your interest in bringing these two things together? And I suppose, what did you find?
I was trying to understand how evolution can get better at evolving over time. And the territory I was thinking about was the evolution of gene regulation networks and how they modify phenotypic variability. So if we assume that genetic variation is random, which it doesn't have to be, but let's assume that for today, one thing at a time, then even though genetic variation is random, the effect of those genetic changes on the phenotype or behavior of an organism are clearly non-random, right? They're shaped and biased by the constraints of development. And an easy way, easy-ish way to model that is with a gene regulation network that says, instead of having one gene affect one aspect of an organism's phenotype, we'll have a network of genetic interactions that this gene upregulates or downregulates other genes, and that can create connections or correlations between them.
So within this gene regulation network, you have different genes which are connected and which in a way are affected by each other.
Adaptation occurs, of course.
This, it turns out, can affect what's known as the phenotypic expression, in other words, the outward expression within an individual. But what can learning theory tell us about these networks?
So I was trying to understand what the effect of natural selection would be on regulatory connections between genes. So it's pretty clear, you know, if I have a gene that has a direct effect on how fast I can run, and running fast is good, then that would be preferred. But what about a genetic change that alters whether the expression of one gene is positively correlated or negatively correlated, upregulates, downregulates the expression of another gene? And I recognized that the way in which natural selection modifies those regulatory interactions follows the same mechanistic principles as the way in which simple learning mechanisms change synaptic connections between neurons in the brain. So there's been a sort of an obvious analogy. If you think about what neural networks do and what gene networks do, if you abstract that mathematically, you can see that there's a sort of similarity in their behavior, that neurons can excite or inhibit the activation of other neurons, and that controls the behavior of the system as a whole. And genes can upregulate or downregulate the behavior of other genes, and that controls the system as a whole. So that sort of level of analogy was clear before already. But neural networks are different from gene networks in our conventional thinking, because the way in which neural networks change the strength of those connections between neurons is with a learning mechanism. A very simple and well-known one is that neurons that fire together wire together. So when two neurons are both activated by the same stimulus, the synaptic connection between them strengthens. And that learning rule is capable of doing all sorts of interesting things, like memory and generalization and anticipating or predicting what kind of behaviors will be good for situations you haven't seen before. But that appeared to have nothing to do with gene networks, because in gene networks, they don't learn, right? They just evolve. The connections, upregulatory and downregulatory connections, are just modified by random mutations. They might get stronger, they might get weaker. And if it works, natural selection would keep it, and if it doesn't work, natural selection doesn't. But if you look at what works, it's the changes that cause genes that are selected together to be wired together that works. So the same mechanistic principle is there, implemented in different ways.
And so in that way, and I'm trying to get my head around this, in that way, I suppose the whole picture, say, you know, natural selection as it's happening, is the kind of brain. And then you're getting these learning mechanisms, which are the genes sort of firing together and wiring together. Is that right?
Yeah. So we can think of the gene network as containing knowledge about what that gene network has been selected for in the past. So if that gene network has been asked to produce a particular pattern of gene expression that was selected in the past, and then another pattern of gene expression for some different environment, and then another pattern for some other environment, that gene network has the capability to store and recall multiple patterns like a learning system would. And we can use learning theory to understand things like how many different patterns can it store, or when will it confuse one pattern for another, or when will it be able to generalize to produce new patterns that are not like something you've seen before. And that helps us understand how the variability in the behavior of the network is, to what extent it's random and to what extent it's guided by past selection.
So according to Richard's theory, this would lead to natural selection itself being sort of able to learn by accumulating knowledge from past experience, in turn enabling it to evolve better in the future. An evolvability of evolution itself, if you will. But not everyone is on board with extended evolutionary synthesis. After this short break, we'll hear why.
I think it's largely irrelevant to working evolutionary biologists. It just seems that it's taking something that's elegant, simple, and enduring and making it into a really specific list of fairly arbitrary details.
And we'll also hear from Massimo again about some more specific details of EES.
In that sense, niche construction is very similar to what I was talking about a few minutes ago. It is a type of epigenetic or non-genetic inheritance.
We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Jason Phipps here, ruler of all things podcast here at The Guardian. Just to let you know that this episode is sponsored by the good people at Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Enjoying this episode of Science Weekly? Then you'll love our Politics Weekly podcast here at The Guardian. Each week, The Guardian's politics team unwind the political spin and delve into the key issues that drives the people in power. Recent episodes include a look at Trump's Russia links, the options for a reunited Labour Party, and an extended live event asking, should economists share the blame for the rise of populism? To subscribe to The Guardian's Politics Weekly podcast, head to theguardian.com/podcasts or get it on your favourite podcast app.
The author of The Vestiges of Creation would, I presume, say that after a certain unknown number of generations, some bird had given birth to a woodpecker and some plant to the mistletoe, and that these had been produced perfect as we now see them. But this assumption seems to me to be no explanation, for it leaves the case of the co-adaptations of organic beings to each other and to their physical conditions of life untouched and unexplained.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis.
Insight into the means of modification and co-adaptation.
Before the break, we heard about extended evolutionary synthesis, an update, if you will, to evolutionary theory, or standard evolutionary theory as we know it. One aspect of this came from Dr. Richard Watson on how evolution itself might, in a way, be evolving. And we also heard from Professor Massimo Pigliucci about the importance of what is colloquially known as Evo-Devo, or evolutionary developmental biology.
Espresso and a banana. That's
But are there other aspects of this extended evolutionary synthesis we should consider? I put that to Massimo. Other factors are also raised in this new theory. So you have things like the influence of the environment, and also sort of the flip side of that, how organisms themselves affect their environments. And these both tie in as well to this new theory. Can you talk me through those and give a few examples of these other aspects?
Sure. So the first one you're referring to is called phenotypic plasticity, and the second one is referred to as niche construction. And phenotypic plasticity happens to be my field of research, so I'll start with that one. So plasticity has been known for a long time, in fact, for since the beginning of the 20th century, but it's always been considered a problem and a nuisance more than anything else until recently. So what it is that we've known for a long time that the same genotype, the same set of genes, if exposed to different environments throughout development, will actually generate different kinds of organisms. They look very different.
One such example of this phenotypic plasticity comes from semi-aquatic or amphibious plants.
Well, it turns out that depending on the flooding regime or depending on the tides and things like that, some of these plants develop leaves that are adapted to life underwater. So they are completely different. They look very different. They have a different physiology and so on and so forth. And then some of these plants develop leaves that are actually better adapted to life above water. And again, those are characterized by completely different sort of morphology, physiology, etc. Indeed, some of these organisms actually produce two very, very different kinds of leaves in the same individual. Right? Some of them are below water and some of them are above water. That kind of incredible flexibility is known as phenotypic plasticity. Now, it turns out that it was considered sort of like a curiosity for decades. But then in the last few decades, we found out that actually phenotypic plasticity not only is ubiquitous, but it has the ability to redirect the evolutionary process itself. Turns out, for instance, that some plastic responses allow in plants or animals to survive under extreme environmental stress in extreme environmental situations, so that the population can persist for a number of generations, which under novel environmental conditions, which gives time to the standard process of mutation and natural selection to kick in and then eventually improve the adaptation of those plants or animals to the new environment. So in other words, phenotypic plasticity buys time to evolution. Without it, a lot of populations, when they go and colonize extreme environments or novel environments, they would simply die. They would not make it.
So just tell me a bit more about how that works in terms of heredity.
So that's a very good question. And that's where a lot of people, including some professionals, believe it or not, actually get confused. So I'm going to try to be as clear as possible. So phenotypic plasticity is a feature of a genotype. So in some sense, it is a reflection of the genetic constitution of the organism, the genetic makeup of an organism, right? So if you mutate, the genome, then the plasticity itself will be altered. Now, that would just make it, you know, if you just look at it that way, it would just make it yet another trait of an organism, just like any other characteristics of living organism. The difference is that because plasticity enhances the flexibility of the organism and therefore its ability to survive and reproduce under novel environmental conditions, what it does is that from time to time, phenotypic plasticity can sort of lead the evolutionary trajectory, meaning that, let's say the environment shifts dramatically. And let me go back to the example of the amphibious plants that I mentioned a minute ago. So let's say that, you know, these are semi-aquatic plants. They are capable of producing two types of leaves, below water, above water. Now, suppose that now we're looking at a number of years where, because of, let's say, climate change, the lake dries up. And so a lot of these plants start finding themselves under entirely terrestrial conditions, right? Now, they're not really terrestrial plants. They don't do well under entirely terrestrial conditions. There's a reason why they're aquatic. They prefer the semi-aquatic. They prefer the amphibious situation. But some of them will be able to survive because the plasticity allows them to hang on, basically, for a number of generations in a suboptimal way, because they're not quite really adapted to the new environment, but they'll persist, they'll be there. During that period, which could be you know, a few generations, a few tens of generations, a few hundreds of generations, depending on how the population dynamic works, during that period, mutations will keep happening. And those mutations, you're right, one of them or one or more of them at some point will alter the initial plastic trait, and it will sort of fix the new phenotype. So the phenotype that was initially just within the range of plastic responses of the organism now becomes kind of fine-tuned. It's like natural selection is now capable of working on it and make it better and better and better, so more fine-tuned to the new environment. The result of that is that the initial bit of the evolutionary response is non-genetic, meaning that there is no mutation. What the plant is doing is surviving because of its already existing plasticity. But over a period of time, that fact that it survives and it hasn't been wiped out immediately allows natural selection basically more time to work and to fine-tune things until you actually get a plant several generations later that is in fact no longer an amphibious plant. Now, if you switch it back to an amphibian environment, it's actually not going to be able to do very well because it has actually lost that ability in order to gain the new one.
So the argument goes that this phenotypic plasticity, instead of just being a feature of evolution, is in some way fundamental to evolution itself. But it's not just phenotypic plasticity.
So one of the classic examples of niche construction is beavers and the dams that they built. Right. So beavers' dams, turns out, are incredibly complicated, sophisticated constructions, but they're not just, you know, like a house or a way to, you know, a refuge or a way to get food more easily or something like that. They dramatically alter the environment, not just for the beaver, but for lots of species that live in the river. That the information that allows the beaver to build the dam is in part, of course, genetic, and there will be nothing surprising about it. It's a particular kind of behavior. Certainly influenced by the genes, and there is nothing weird about it. But part of that information actually comes from the environment. If you put the beaver in a completely different environment or in an environment where there is different material constructions and things like that, it's going to have much more of a hard time actually building the dam in the proper way. So part of that information that is transmitted from one generation to the other, it's not genetic directly, it's environmental. There has to be a particular type of environment that is interpreted by the beaver in a particular type of way. But now things get complicated because it is the beaver itself that actually changes the environment every generation. It's not like the environment comes with dams. The dams are actually the result of the beaver's own activity. If you model this mathematically, it turns out that niche construction turns out to provide a parallel channel for the inheritance of information that is pertinent to the survival and reproduction of the organism. So that organisms that engage in niche construction have both genetic inheritance and this kind of environmental construction inheritance. In that sense, niche construction is very similar to what I was talking about a few minutes ago. It is a type of epigenetic or non-genetic inheritance.
A compelling case, it would seem. That said, this extended evolutionary synthesis is still very much something of a fringe theory when compared to standard evolutionary theory.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, morning Joan, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
This is Joan Straussman.
My name is Joan Straussman. I'm an evolutionary biologist at Washington University in St. Louis. I have a fancy title, which is the Charles Rebstock Chair of Biology. Charles Rebstock is famous for whiskey distilleries.
We spoke to Joan via Skype and began by asking her how she defines these two camps within evolutionary biology.
I would say that evolutionary theory brought genes to Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. It's often been called the modern synthesis. It's really the theoretical foundation for understanding adaptation and speciation. At its core is the fact that evolutionary change happens when gene frequencies change, because the genes are what underlie our traits. And this happens through the processes of mutation, migration, drift, and natural selection. So that's, in a nutshell, evolutionary theory. What we evolutionary biologists actually do is far more specific and detailed than that. And I think that's one of the real strengths of evolutionary theory, is that it's a really simple and broad theory, and that is why it has been so robust to all of the new things that we evolutionary biologists can do these days. By contrast, what people are once called the postmodern evolutionary synthesis, and I think are now calling the extended evolutionary synthesis, it does not deny that gene-based processes of natural selection are important. And what it does is it just picks out a few cases of things that are important that they feel have been neglected. So it has a bit of a whiny tone. And these things are phenotypic plasticity, niche construction, non-genetic inheritance, and development. And of course, all of these things are very important to biology and under specific conditions to evolution. But it's a small list of you know, lots of different things that are important to evolution.
Safe to say, Joan isn't the biggest fan of extended evolutionary synthesis.
And how natural selection operates on...
Her objections very much echo many of those in the field, who claim that updates to evolutionary theory happen all the time and cover much more than just, say, niche construction.
So if I had to pick some things that I think really changed in evolutionary biology since the modern synthesis, they would be phylogenetics and social evolution. Those two things have really changed, probably as far as processes go. What we know about molecular evolution would certainly be right up there. These people aren't going around talking about how they have a new evolutionary synthesis. So if I sound a bit like a rant, I'm not ranting. I'm just kind of an excitable person. So I'll just tell you one other thing, and that is one of the things the extension people talk about is that genes were a blueprint for development. And genes were just simply never a blueprint. If you want an analogy, they might be more like a recipe than a blueprint. And this is because development, of course, happens in a certain order and environment, and will not work without that. You can't have development proceed normally if some things don't precede other things. And as many of my colleagues have argued recently, you can't even have animal development in a non-microbial world. So we get that. It's not a blueprint. But of course, even in a blueprint, there has to be an order. You're not going to finish the bathroom out carefully before you've framed the roof.
For these reasons, scientists like Joan see extended evolutionary synthesis as not only impractical, but also irrelevant for working biologists.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic.
So are the distinctions between the two approaches anything more than just semantics? Something I put to Massimo.
So before I answer the question, let me say something about semantics, because the phrase, you know, well, it's just semantics, is often used to sort of dismiss entire discussions as if they were irrelevant. But semantics, of course, is crucial because it is about the meaning of words. And especially in science, the meaning of words is crucial. If we don't agree on what words mean, then we're not even having a conversation. But I think there is much more there than just semantics, so to speak. And that's this. So the people that say that the extended synthesis is just a storm in a teacup and it's, you know, oh, we have known all this stuff and it's, you know, we just can deal with it with the regular tools of the already existing toolbox, I think that they have not studied their history carefully. Because what happened at the transition between Darwinism, the original Darwinism, and the modern synthesis was precisely the kind of thing that is happening now. That is, it's not like the modern synthesists had actually invented anything new. That's why it's called the synthesis. It's not like we didn't know about natural selection in the 1920s and 30s. It's not like we didn't know about genetic inheritance. We did. We just didn't know how to put them together exactly. And that was the major accomplishment of the modern synthesis. And I can imagine a critic of the modern synthesis in the 1930s saying, well, but you haven't come up with anything new. We knew about Mendel and we knew about Darwin. What's all the fuss about? I think that's what's happening now with the extended synthesis. Yes, we have known about epigenetic inheritance for a while, although not that long. We've known about phenotypic plasticity for a long while. We've known about a number of other things. But we have had trouble sort of putting them together into one coherent picture to see how they work with each other, to be able to generate new research questions and better models of, you know, mathematical models of how evolution works, which is why, again, we're not calling for a revolution here. We're not saying, you know, throw away the whole thing and start from scratch. We're simply saying it's time to do another expansion. It's time to do another reassessment of and see how things actually cohere with each other.
Whether or not evolutionary theory needs a new expansion, Joan believes disagreements have an important role in science.
Of course. I mean, we make new discoveries, we have new tools, we have new theories. The most powerful new theories inspire us to start collecting kinds of data that we didn't collect before. And without this and without peer review and a respect for facts, something challenging every day in my country, science just doesn't proceed. I mean, science is simply an ordered way of understanding the world in which we live.
In this and in all other perplexing cases, I have invariably found that our knowledge, imperfect though it be, of variation under domestication, afforded the best and safest clue.
Special thanks this week to Massimo Pigliucci, Richard Watson, and Joan Straussman. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly. For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.